From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Today I'll talk with Maxine Margolis, an anthropologist at the University of Florida and Columbia University's Institute of Latin American Studies. She spent her career studying the thousands of college-educated Brazilians who come to the United States every year.
In 1 week in the U.S., even doing menial work, like cleaning apartments, they earn the same as they make in 4 weeks in Brazil.
But first, we'll continue last week's discussion of the ongoing migrant crisis with my colleague Mitchell Smith, who leads OU's European Union Center. He'll explain the EU policy responses to the refugees and other migrants arriving in Europe.
This really gets to the fundamental identity of the European Union and the values that the European Union represents, and whether or not it's going to be true to those values.
These conversations are all coming up right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Mitchell Smith, as an expert on European politics, and in particular the European Union, we have to go back and address once again this horrible refugee crisis, the migrants that are coming into Europe. I've talked about it recently with Rebecca about the actual humanitarian concerns and what's going on in Eastern Europe. But from your perspective, tell us what's going on within the European Union, because there are some political maneuverings going on, some proposals about how to address this issue. They obviously can't get away without, you know, discussing it and addressing it. So tell us what's happening there.
Yes. Well, first of all, I would underscore that from my perspective, this is a bigger crisis, a more existential crisis for the European Union than the Greek debt crisis and the economic crisis. We've spent a long time over the past several years talking about that and will the Eurozone break up and what would be the consequences, et cetera. To me, this really gets to the fundamental identity of the European Union and the values that the European Union represents and whether or not it's going to be true to those values. And where things stand right now is a situation in which there is a great deal of uncertainty about whether or not the European Union is going to fulfill its obligations in a way that reflects solidarity among the member states.
So the proposal currently is to accept asylum seekers, like 160,000 of them. But there are nearly a million or more refugees that are coming in by land, by sea. I mean, we've got issues with now, European countries now asking the UN for some support. So this doesn't seem to be adequate. I mean, first of all, how likely is it that member states are actually going to agree to quotas and that they must take a certain number of refugees? How likely is that? And then is this really adequate enough? I mean, this seems like a drop in the bucket.
Absolutely. I think you touch on all the open questions. The quota system is something against which there's already a very significant backlash before there's even a formal proposal on the table. There were discussions in the spring and summer about a 40,000 refugee quota, and there was not agreement on that because some, particularly the East European countries, East Central European countries, are absolutely against a quota system. Now they're talking about 160,000. The president of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, recently gave his State of the European Union address to the European Parliament. This was in Strasbourg. And in the speech, he said that there is not sufficient Europe in the Union and there's not sufficient Union. And I think he's exactly right. On the other hand, there are already people saying his speech wasn't forceful enough. My impression is that Juncker is talking about the problem as it stands today. The East Central European countries are looking backwards, and Angela Merkel is the only one who's looking forward. And she is playing a leadership role in saying, we need to go beyond, even if we could agree on this 160,000, this problem is going to continue, it's going to grow, and we have to figure out what to do about it. And we have to do it in a way that shares the burden.
Well, beyond the politics of this, of course, the citizens of Europe across these countries are responding in a number of different ways. You see, as some have said, kind of the best of European values. Lots of people coming out, delivering food, humanitarian assistance, taking people in. Others that are, you know, engaging in rather hostile interactions with these refugees and migrants. I suppose that's not surprising, right? You're going to have a spectrum here. But like you said to begin with, you know, this really does speak to the value of human life and why these folks are leaving. They're leaving for a reason. And what do you do about it? I mean, how do you ultimately address this, even as citizens, let alone as a political body, an economic body?
Yes, and this is why I see this as such a crucial moment for the European Union, because if the European Union is meaningful in any sense, it is as a community of values. And the response, frankly, from the Hungarian government, for example, has been disturbing. Now, it's true, as you say, that some Hungarian citizens have provided support, but the Hungarian government has taken steps that have been hostile, that have deliberately provided a hostile reception to refugees who have really suffered to get where they are.
Well, Mitchell, it's so good to have you here to talk about this. And the fact that you think this is a bigger crisis than the economic crisis is really telling. So thank you very much for giving us your insight.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. We welcome your comments on the Worldviews page of our website, kgou.org. We're also on Twitter, at WorldviewsKGOU, and I tweet, at Suzek Rilat. You can also find all of our past conversations and subscribe to our weekly podcast on iTunes. Next, I'll talk with Maxine Margolis, a longtime University of Florida anthropologist who studies Brazilian immigrants in the United States and other countries. I'm Suzek Rilat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rilat. Today, I'm joined by Maxine Margolis. For the past 45 years, she's researched and taught anthropology at the University of Florida in Gainesville. She focuses specifically on Brazilian culture and society, international migration, and cross-cultural gender roles. She's the author of the books An Invisible Minority, Brazilians in New York City, and Goodbye Brazil, Emigres from the Land of Soccer and Samba. Maxine Margolis, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
This work that you've been doing, you've been working in Brazil for many, many years, but this most recent book of yours, Goodbye Brazil, really focuses on how and why people are leaving the country of Brazil, why Brazilians are immigrating and leaving the country. Tell us a little bit about why that's happening.
Well, it started about in the late 1980s, early 1990s, when there was a lot of real dire economic problems in Brazil, hyperinflation, high unemployment, low salaries, high cost of living. And middle-class Brazilians, particularly middle-class Brazilians, were having trouble maintaining their lifestyles because of these issues. And so they began to leave Brazil in reasonably large numbers for a country that had no history of emigration, only immigration, to take jobs in the industrialized world, the U.S., several countries in Europe, Japan, that paid far more than they could earn in Brazil. And the ratio I always use is 1 to 4. Which they told me about, is in 1 week in the U.S., even doing menial work like cleaning apartments or waiting on tables, they earn the same as they make in 4 weeks in Brazil. So the ratio was 1 to 4. Even though in Brazil, many of them had what we would call white-collar jobs that one would think would be reasonably well-paid, but they weren't, especially not given the high cost of living.
So there's no one segment of society that's leaving and others are staying. So we wouldn't consider it necessarily brain drain in the sense that the educated classes are leaving. It's everyone. People that are working and cleaning homes as well.
Yeah, it's not everyone, because very poor people don't leave because they don't have the resources to leave. Initially, through about the year 2000, it was middle class and lower middle class Brazilians. People who were nurses and school teachers, who were considered lower middle class in Brazil, who took terrible salaries, as well as middle class people with white collar jobs, even people with professional jobs who had attended university, who simply could not get positions in which they could use their expertise, which paid middle-class lifestyle wages. So that was really the catalyst for them leaving, even though when they came, for example, to the U.S., they took menial jobs that they would never, ever consider doing in Brazil, such as cleaning houses.
So the economy, though, was booming in Brazil for quite some time. But the cost of living is what you're saying is really as a result of that booming economy that really drove a lot of people out.
Yeah. Well, there have been a whole series of boom busts in the Brazilian economy. You know, today it's up and tomorrow it's down sort of thing. Like in 2010, it was really booming. And some Brazilians who were living abroad said, well, you know, maybe let's go back. Let's try our luck. Let's see what's happening. And that slowly faded, and today they have a very low growth rate. I forget what it is. I think it's less than 1%. It's very low, and so things have changed once again. So there's no, I would say, there's no single pattern in that, but definitely the initial driving force were the early 1990s economic conditions that I've described.
So primarily economic. Are there any other factors? Are there other social or cultural factors that also might be? Because I know Brazil's obviously a very diverse country. Yeah. Most people don't realize how diverse it really is.
Yeah.
And so do you have other kinds of societal issues that are at play?
Well, in terms of coming to the U.S. in particular, Brazil is absolutely awash in U.S. media, movies, music, television shows, and so on. And so the imagination of the Brazilian, I would say, especially, again, middle-class people, is to come to this land who they have extremely, I would say, idealized versions of in their heads. But so there's definitely, aside from the economic issues, a feeling of adventure, of wanting to know another country, and particularly a country that receives so much attention in Brazil and is seen as so, you know, such a world leader in that sense.
So the majority of them are coming to the United States?
Yes. More are coming to the United States than any other country. Second place would be, in terms of industrialized countries to which they go, would be Japan.
And so what's the connection there to Japan?
The connection is that in the early 20th century, many thousands of Japanese left Japan and settled in Brazil, particularly in southern Brazil. And in 1990, the Japanese government and Japanese industry realized they did not have sufficient labor force to do jobs that were considered extremely undesirable by the Japanese themselves, so that they would legally, basically, import labor. But the important thing about the labor was that it looked like them, that is, people of Japanese ancestry. The feeling was that if they were Japanese, by ancestry, they would easily fit into Japanese society. The problem is most of them didn't speak Japanese. They speak Portuguese. They're, you know, second, third generation. And they are culturally Brazilian. There's nothing Japanese about them. Yes, some of them have, you know, eat Japanese food or go to Japanese restaurants in Brazil. But it's very sort of a light touch, and they really don't know Japanese culture. So there have been all kinds of cultural conflicts once they get there in terms of, I was telling the other class, the inability to properly recycle and to play loud music. And the Japanese simply say they look like us, but they sure don't act like us, is a way of summarizing the issue.
Well, certainly. I think if you grow up in a different place, you're a different person.
Absolutely. Just because you're racially similar.
Exactly.
So it was quite a shock to the Japanese.
I'm speaking with Maxine Margolis, a longtime anthropologist at the University of Florida and Columbia University's Institute of Latin American Studies. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. Welcome back to Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat, the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. This half hour, I've been talking with Maxine Margolis, an anthropologist who studies immigrants from Brazil. When we left off, she told me about the thousands of Brazilians who leave South America for countries like the United States and Japan. Well, let's talk about the linguistic similarities. So I'm thinking you mentioned that they're going to the U.S. and Japan, but what about Portugal? I mean, the Brazilian Brazil is a Portuguese colony, and they share a language. So I mean,
and in fact,
but Portugal isn't necessarily the best place to go economically either, right? Is this maybe
it
part
is
of the problem?
Or isn't? It is and isn't in a sense. Yes, you're exactly right because they speak Portuguese, the mother country. Beginning also in the 1990s, a lot of professional Brazilians left for Portugal. They got jobs there in areas in which they were trained, such as marketing and IT and television production and so on. These sort of very high-level jobs that paid well, better in Portugal than they did in Brazil. And moreover, there was need for them in Portugal. Portugal did not have that many people trained in those areas. And of course, Brazilian television is absolutely world-class production. So this was very attractive. That's one of the few examples where Brazilians can actually, as immigrants, can actually get jobs in the areas in which they were trained in Brazil. Now, that not all Brazilians who went to Portugal are of that educational caliber. So there were poorer Brazilians who went working class, who worked in construction, and so on and so forth.
So what has the government been doing in Brazil about this, this issue? I mean, are they concerned at all, the Brazilian government, about people leaving the country?
Well, it's still such a drop in the bucket because Brazil is a country of 200 million people, and we're talking about maybe 2 or 3 million who live outside the country, something like that. So, you know, 1 or 2%. So it's very small. It's not like Mexico or the Philippines or what have you. At first, I would say the Brazilian government pretty much ignored these people. But in more recent years, particularly after Lula became president of Brazil, there was more attention paid to this sort of expatriate community. One thing that was done, it became much easier to send money from, say, the U.S. to Brazil, to your relatives in Brazil. You could do it through banking. You didn't have to go to Western Union and pay high fees. It was virtually free, and money could be received at any bank in Brazil by your relatives and withdrawn with no problem at all. So that was one of the things the government did. Now, since 2008, as many people from Brazilians from the U.S. and also from Western Europe and Japan have been returning to Brazil as they've lost jobs due to the recession, the government again sort of woke up and they published a little book about returning to Brazil and how to readapt and how to invest your money and this sort of thing. So there's been what I would say some attention, particularly on the ability to send money home more than anything else, but it hasn't really been a big issue. There is, however, some attempt on the part of Brazilians living abroad to get the government to pay more attention to them by perhaps having a representative in the Brazilian government, in the Brazilian Congress. That hasn't happened so far, but there has been lobbying, particularly by Brazilians in Europe, for that to take place.
For representation.
For some kind of representation.
Yes, diaspora.
Yes. Like, I think Haiti has a special representative in the government that represents the Haitians living outside of Haiti. It's the same, would be the same idea. But it hasn't, they've lobbied, but to my knowledge, it hasn't come to pass.
What about Brazil's connection to other Latin American countries and in terms of immigration and migration going back and forth?
Yeah.
I mean, it is the, of course, Brazil is the Portuguese-speaking country in Latin America, and the rest is largely Spanish-speaking. But nonetheless, they share a lot in terms of their culture and way of life. And so what about that relationship?
Well, you have in fact, a large number of poor Brazilians, uneducated Brazilians, many with high rates of illiteracy, who go to some of the neighboring countries, particularly Paraguay. Paraguay has more Brazilians than any foreign country other than the U.S. We don't know how many because they now enter the third generation, and many of them are basically stateless because they're not recognized by the Paraguayan government, and they have no documentation to prove they're came from Brazil, or their parents or grandparents came from Brazil. But those are a very different kind of immigrant. They are very poor. They are landless. They're looking for jobs of whatever in agriculture, sharecropping. They've been pushed out of Brazil, southern Brazil in particular, because of mechanization of agriculture and land consolidation. So there's been, and that's actually older. That started in the late 60s, much earlier than this other, but large numbers of people have gone. And smaller numbers of Brazilians go to Venezuela or to Guyana to work in the mines, to work as rubber tappers in Bolivia. Smallish numbers. Even go to Argentina. Middle-class Brazilians, there's a fairly small population of middle-class Brazilians who have gone to Buenos Aires to take jobs that actually pay better than equivalent jobs in Brazil. But that's a fairly small number of people, I believe.
Well, there's a lot of attention on Brazil these days, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's to many of us around the world, it's still an up-and-coming country. Mm-hmm. It's part of the BRICS, as we call mm-hmm. them, Brazil, mm-hmm. Russia, India, yeah, China, South Africa. So, you know, and they had the World Cup, and now they're going to have the summer 2016 Olympics. I mean, there's a lot of attention being paid to Brazil.
Yeah.
So do you see some reversal, perhaps, in this happening, in that maybe Brazilians won't be leaving the country as much? But I know their economy is still struggling. Do you see many might be coming back? There just seems to be a lot of movement going on.
Yeah, there is, although recently the cost of living has been just astronomical. And one of the problems for immigrants is if they're sending money home, well, if they're sending dollars, that's wonderful because the dollar is worth so much against the local currency. But when that, for a while, that was reversed, and so it became less attractive to work abroad. And that, again, keeps changing. I would say the biggest catalyst for sending Brazilians home back to Brazil is high unemployment in Western Europe, in Spain and Portugal in particular, maybe somewhat less in Italy, and in parts of the U.S. Now, you never had Brazilians working in construction very much, very little, and mostly in service sector jobs, in service jobs, in restaurants, and nannies and housekeepers and that sort of thing. But as the American economy had its problems, you know, people gave up their house cleaners, for example, or their nannies, or they didn't go out to eat in restaurants as much. And so that all impacts employment. And we do know that a certain number of Brazilians have definitely returned to Brazil. What we don't know is how many. We don't know how many left to begin with, and we really don't know how many returned. There really aren't very good records.
Well, Maxine, thank you so much for being here today. Most of us are really watching Brazil and how it's developing, and I think this gives us another thing to think about. So thank you very much.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with anthropologist Maxine Margolis from the University of Florida and Columbia University's Institute of Latin American Studies. You can find additional details online at kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews as part of a partnership with the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Brian Hardzinski and Sam Dupre produce the show, and our digital content intern is Ivy Dyson. For Mitchell Smith, I'm Suzette Guerlotte.